author and a liberal toddler. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Cold River Mountain Watch. Cold River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Sound notation for the evening. Thank you, Sparky. Sounds is scratchy. Oh, dear God. It's a minute past the hour. This is the horn. Head on RadioNetwork.com. We will tinker with the sound as best we may through the throughout the remainder of the program. The horn is a little something we like to call conversation radio, but you know that, unless you are brand new to all of this. Most easily accessed at headonradionetwork.com, but also equally available on smartphone apps like TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio and the TuneIn Internet Radio app and sites like Streama.com and Dar.fm. The list is getting longer and longer and longer. Roku devices, that kind of thing. The podcast address for the show, this program, is always available at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program, Head On With Bob Kincaid, or you can also go and get it at iTunes. So far, so good. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is Friday. It is the first day of February 2013. Friday on the front porch. And I'm a little bit tired, but not so much the worse for wear that we couldn't have a go at it this evening. You know, we've been doing the Families USA Radio Road Health Action 2013 for the past 2 days. And we got back to the studio, and I got to thinking, you know, we really need to get a show in this evening because it's, because it's not exactly what you would call normal. Those Radio Row affairs. It's more like, it's kind of a Sunday line. I mean, that's not a criticism. It's just there's a lot of people talking about a lot of different stuff, and it's very, very chaotic and very stressful. All right, let's see. Does any of this make any difference? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to... shoot. There's not much I can do to change things here. We've had equipment problems at Radio Row and different equipment problems here. And Lord knows it gets frustrating. I'm trying to figure... Hey, Frank. Come here. All right, I'm going to try to remedy this. It's got to be frustrating for y'all as well as for me. I'm calling up a really, really tired old pig. And what Ferg is going to do is he's going to read the poem. Now, I'll sneak away and try to monitor him reading it. So Ferg, as the entertainment portion of this program, is going to read Bad Old 19th Century Poetry by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I've got an even better idea, because it's colder than hell outside. Okay, so I'm going to go and listen and see what this scratchiness is. Jesus Christ. Hang on. I have to know what this sounds like in order to even try to fix it. Be right back.
I can imagine their worst nightmare.
We got a price check on these Tampax Pearls Super Size.
And then somebody from the back of the store who misheard Tampax's thumbtacks replies,
"Is it the kind you push in with your thumb or the kind you pound in with a hammer?"
Brilliant. Okay, Sergi, from the next room, I just heard my lovely wife, Agnes, declare that you are a bad man. Pound in with a hammer.
You know I'm monitoring
this. Yes, I know. You're listening to everyone.
Bad, bad.
Bad, Sergi, bad.
But it's okay. I love you, Sergi.
She loves you anyway. At least Sergi acknowledges the reality that might... Oh, God. So that's where we find ourselves as we come to the close of this truncated first hour. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We've got a call on hold on Skype, and we will go to it out of the break.
No eye contact, I'll beat you down. Cause you know that's not a scary hero. You'll never find a human that feels school supplies. And if you do, let me know who, and I'll be down.
I like to poop out the bad vibes. That's right, I'm the best one. And when we do a show, I always start with this. And then usually around 5, I lay down. Then I poop, poop, poop on the floor. Piano.
You gotta flush the toilet. Yeah, see, that's right. Professional baby. I'm gonna find a chicken fight, then go poo poo. Mama told me she wrote me a note. She forgot that I'm a soft machine man. Honey. Looks like we got a big mean dookie on deck. And I hate those greenish potatoes with them soggy fish sticks.
When I'm on the pot. To working for hours, wash out down there. When I'm dumping my log,
everybody poops and that they dump their an android. And should be a Street Journal to see what they were doing, see if they could generate any ideas of doing something locally. If I had read that during my tenure as a reporter, I would have been tempted to ask an editor, can we post this as the most bizarre thing to have run in a major newspaper? I mean, good heavens. But then again, I think what we are seeing is a mental meltdown on the right. The questioning of Hillary Clinton generally showed Senators Johnson and Paul to be unworthy of commanding a garbage gal, let alone being in the U.S. Senate. I thought she handled herself with class, and it's just how weird it's getting out there is astonishing even me, and I consider myself hard to surprise. As for a thorn in my side, I'll nominate Harry Reid for a rather watered-down filibuster, but then again, what should I expect from a man who's in a warrior would probably lose an arm wrestling match with Jiminy Cricket? Am I wrong?
No.
I mean, good heavens. Reid makes me seem like Conan the Barbarian in battle rage. And I'm generally considered a very calm, collected person. I mean, the deal he struck, yes, it does make some changes around the edges, but I fear it doesn't do enough, and I'm afraid what Reid fails to understand that this is not the gentleman's game that he entered politics long ago. It is now roller derby instead of cricket, to give you a sports analogy.
And you know what? I think that's our first cricket analogy in quite some time, but very true. Very true.
Right, and it's just that I'm afraid that we have a good chance of seeing little done in this Congress for the next 2 years, except for the Republicans exposing themselves for who they are and all their horror. Good heavens, the author of that Wall Street Journal piece would probably faint on hearing that line, but yes.
I mean, we're trying to be serious here, but...
Oh, I am. I'm trying to. But one thing we have to remember is we have to be at the leading edge of change, and there can be surprises. I mean, this week I was delightfully surprised that Bibi Netanyahu got his comeuppance in the Israeli elections. He thought, well, I could declare election early and get, strengthen my position. What he did is he merged with he merged Likud with the Israel Beitenu party, lost 25% of the strength he had in the, had expected in the combined ticket, and now he is, stuck with a Hobson's choice. To lie with a group of right-wing parties, which are so fracturous that offending one will cause his coalition to collapse, but going for a more centrist coalition that will likely push him in ways that he doesn't want to go. So I think the fact that we pretty much had a split decision in the Israeli elections proves something about politics. If you actually campaign to people, talk about the issues they want, they'll listen. And Netanyahu, much like Mitt Romney, kept on trying to portray himself as a popular, likable guy, a strong figure. In fact, that's what Netanyahu ran on, and it backfired. People want ideas. They want solutions. And I think what we're going to see worldwide are more people pressing their so-called leaders and making change. And this is, I think, what the right wing is most afraid of. Change. It was William F. Buckley who said that a conservative is a man who stands, in a place seeing the forward march of history and yells, halt. To paraphrase him. And I think what we're seeing in a lot of places worldwide, but particularly in the U.S., they're saying halt, and people are wondering, who the heck are these crazy guys after all?
And I don't know, Will, if it's, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing, but I think there's something else at work here. And I think we can see it in a wide variety of arenas. And that's this. It is not just that they are afraid of change. They have no, you know, the right wing complains about us saying that, you know, we have no moral center, we have no moral compass. If you don't believe what they believe, then you can't possibly be moral, right?
You're familiar. You know, yes, they wrap themselves in their holy books and their flags and say, if you disagree with us, you are a heretic. And unpatriotic. That, you can see that around the world.
Right. But you see, the problem is they are the ones who lack that center.
Exactly.
Because the reason we are in the spot we are in, the reason the planet is burning up, the reason for the flooding, the reason for the godforsaken wars over oil and other resources, is because we are no longer able to make those ethical choices based upon doing what is right. See, I have no problem thinking that if Will was in charge, the Iraq War would never have happened. If I'd been in charge, the Iraq War would never have happened. Virtually anybody in the Horn family would never have taken us into that war based upon those lies, because those lies were immoral and unethical. And a complete rejection of everything that should be within our value set. But the other side don't make decisions that way. They make their decisions based upon how much money they can make from it.
Exactly. Money and or power and prestige. I mean, it's as if we have one group of people who are trying to use logic and ethics, whatever source those ethics are derived from, as a basis of decision, and another which is essentially treating the world as a high-stakes poker game.
But not just that. It's not just that they've profetized it. It is that their profetizing of it actually prevents the real answers from ever being found. It's not just that they get it wrong. They get it wrong in such a way as to keep us from ever getting it right. And, of course, I think for instance, of climate change, though. Eventually,
we can't have an honest discussion.
Well, we can't have an honest discussion, Will, because they're not honest.
Exactly.
But the other thing is, their dishonesty will keep this world burning until it's too late. And see, one of the things that I fear in the future is that when climate change does become, and I was thinking about this because of Senator Kerry's remarks earlier today about how he's going to, he wants to use the Secretary of State's platform to address climate change. I can very easily see a future. Is it 100 years from now? I don't know. Is it 50? I don't know. But it doesn't take much of an imagination to envision a future in which the rest of the world addresses the issues of climate change and then looks at us with 5% of the world's population consuming at least 25% and maybe more of the world's resources and decides that we have to be stopped.
That is actually something I have thought can happen. Because if we are the main source of the problem of global warming and something can be done, if we are not doing our part, the other nations will, by logic, any logical standard, have to act in their best interest. In fact, some would even say that acting against us would be in our best interest because they can only conclude that the leadership has gone crazy. In that nightmare scenario,
Well, the problem is it's not even necessarily a nightmare. You know, zombies are a nightmare.
Right.
This is a reality.
And closer and closer to the tipping point.
Well, I'm sure you saw the North Korea story today, right?
I missed it as I've been researching for a job interview, but
okay. Well, I mean, here's the long and the short of it. The North Koreans say that they're testing more weapons, and that they're going to have intercontinental ballistic missiles, and all of them are aimed at us.
Gee, doesn't that just make the people in the defense industry ecstatic for a new arms race?
Well, I mean, I don't think we have to enter into an arms race with them. What it's going to do, however, is make the blood-sodden peanackers like Elliot Abrams and Wolfowitz and, you know, those chicken hawk bastards, it's going to make them salivate with glee and start planning on what they're going to buy when their stock options in various and sundry defense industries go through the roof, because they're going to start hollering for, I mean, they're already hollering for war with Iran, and Iran hasn't done anything. North Korea really, really does have nuclear weapons. But the thing is, what North Korea is doing, this is the kind of thing you get out of North Korea periodically when North Korea starts to starve.
Exactly.
It's January in North Korea, too.
Right. And as they don't have much cropland, they have to rattle the saber as opposed to the tin cup.
Well, that is their tin cup.
Exactly.
That's our cue to send food. But the thing is, North Korea, Pakistan, India. Which one of these countries can really, you can argue that India is stable, but India is India has a rising middle class that are absolutely screaming for the perks that a middle class gets when it arises. You know, that's why a mountain in my home county in West Virginia is going to India by boat. Because it's coal. They want they want all that electricity. They want lots and lots of gasoline to run lots and lots of cars. And we built the model, Will. We don't, it's extremely racist for us to say to them, no, we could have it, but you can't. Just like there's a certain element of racism involved in saying that, you know, white nations can be trusted with nuclear weapons, but, you know, Iran couldn't be. There's a lot of privilege that shines through on all of this stuff, but there is also a future to be considered out there. And that is a future where, I mean, surely to goodness somebody at one of these, you know, the Bland Institute or whatever. Did I lose you, Will? There are things to be considered about what happens in terms of climate change. And what the nexus is when it really gets ugly between that and nuclear-armed nations. And that should give us tremendous pause for concern. Unless Will jumps back in, the Skype line is open. It is about 18 minutes past the hour. The number is, of course, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Thanks for putting up with all the technical fun. But I'm hearing from John Fox. He says we've got some stuff to work out, but the sound is cleaner than it sounded in ages, and that's really inspiring. Now, Bob Kincaid Horn gets you to the Skype account. I don't know what happened to Will. I hate that because we were in mid-conversation. What I was talking about earlier, though, All right, we're going to try this one more time. See if anything at all is happening. Push that up, gain it up a little bit. Let's look in the chat room, see if anybody's home. Thank God. Sounds okay then. Well, bless your hearts. Thanks for sticking around and letting me know. All right, so now we can hit the record button. You know what? Let's just do this right.
With very little impact on the global climate. So in this
now, right in what you just heard there, is the complete right-wing brief against doing anything about climate change in a nutshell. Consumption's going to go up, and emissions are going to go up, and it's going to be China and India's fault. And since it's going to be their fault, well, there's no sense in us doing anything about it. And the right-wingers, because they're not very good at that whole thinking thing, say, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could run everything on windmills and solar panels, and the world would still keep on getting hotter. Because, you know, it's solar flares, anywho. Nothing to do with it. It's solar flares. I seen it on Newsmuck the other day. So let's go back and just sort of take, yeah.
Climate change has been a big issue that you've been concerned about, focused on. It seems over the next 25 years, the global energy needs are going to increase about 50%, that emissions are going to go up significantly, primarily because of China and India, and we could do significant harm to the U.S. economy, I think, by putting additional rules and regulations with very little impact on the global climate. So in this tight budget environment with so many competing American priorities, I would ask you to give considerable thought into limiting significantly resources that would not help us as an economy, not help us as a country, and not help us globally in perhaps the efforts that you might be pursuing there. I don't know if you have specific thoughts on
it. I do.
And before we get to Senator Kerry's thoughts, just a couple of observations on Senator Barrasso's. You know, I think we used to have a can of that under the sink there. We used it on the doorknobs. Barrasso, cleans your barass up. Do you notice, we're going to have a 50% higher demand for energy. He just assumes that that has to be hydrocarbon energy. When in fact, China is building wind turbines for all it's worth. His assumptions are not necessarily reflected in the realities of these other countries. Because China and India are ramping up the wind. Are ramping up their access to solar power, will quite possibly invent Grid 2.0, and we'll end up buying it from them because of the Barrassos of the world. But he blows right past it. He can't even bear to say wind and solar. Isn't that just, and you wouldn't necessarily know that if you weren't constantly thinking about it. And what he says about unnecessary regulation and costs, that's not grounded in reality. But John Kerry has to try to be, you know, a decent human being, so you get, but still, this is pretty good. If you are someone who cares about the climate, these words are good words. The question is whether or not they can be followed by good deeds, good acts, good actions. Because again, we live in a culture that is crippled in terms of being able to do things that are right when we are confronted with things that our betters think are either profitable or expedient or both.
A lot of specific thoughts about it, Senator, more than we're going to have time to do now, so I'm not going to abuse that privilege, but I will say this to you. the solution to climate change is energy policy. And the opportunities of energy policy so vastly outweigh the downsides that you're expressing concern about. And I will spend a lot of time trying to persuade you and other colleagues of this. You want to do business and do it well in America? We got to get into the energy race. Other countries are in it. I can tell you in Massachusetts that the fastest growing sector of our economy is clean energy and energy efficiency companies. And they're growing faster than any other sector. The same is true in California. This is a job creator. I can't emphasize that strongly enough. The market that made America rich, richer, we've always been rich, but the market that made us richer in the 1990s was the technology market. It was a $1 trillion market with 1 billion users. And we created greater wealth in America than has been created even in the raging time of no income tax and the Pierpont's, Morgan's, and Mellon's, and Carnegie's, and Rockefeller's. We created more wealth in the 1990s, and every single quintile of American worker went up. Everyone. So we can do this recognizing that the energy market is a $6 trillion market compared to one, with, what, 4 billion, 5 billion users today going up to 9 billion over the course of the next 20, 30 years. This is a place for us to recognize what other countries are doing and what our states that are growing are doing, which is there's an extraordinary amount of opportunity in modernizing America's energy grid. We don't even have a grid in America. We have a great big open gap in the circle of America. An East Coast grid, a West Coast grid, you've got a Texas grid, and then you've got a line that goes from Chicago out over to the Dakotas. We can't sell energy from Minnesota to Arizona, or from Arizona to Massachusetts, or to the cold states, and so forth. It doesn't make sense. And we can't be a modern country if we don't fix that infrastructure. So I would respectfully say to you that climate change is not something to be feared in response to. I mean, the steps to respond to it, it's to be feared if we don't. 3,500 communities in our nation last year broke records for heat. We had a rail that, because of the heat, bent, and we had a derailment as a result of it. We had record fires. We had record levels of damage from Sandy, $70 billion. If we can't see the downside of spending that money and risking lives for all the changes that are taking place to agriculture, to our communities, the ocean, and so forth, then we're just ignoring what science is telling us. So I will be a passionate advocate about this, but not based on ideology, based on facts, based on science. And I hope to sit with all of you and convince you this $6 trillion market is worth millions of American jobs and leadership, and we better go after it.
At least Senator Kerry understands that the way to convince people to take climate change seriously, at least where these 1% plutocrats are concerned, is to explain to them that they can get even richer. But there are numbers involved here, and I am abject failure at numbers. The alternative energy response to climate change market is, according to Senator Kerry, somewhere around a $6 trillion market. How much is the oil market? How much is the gas market? How much is the coal market? And how much do those real-time numbers have to do with the money that can be made in the future? For instance, our buddy Andy just pointing out, subject line, China, $18 billion in subsidies to alternative energy. Have you seen the pollution in Beijing? Yes, I have. It's eight times above the unhealthy level. It's beyond hazardous to one's health. China is way, way outspending us in alternative energy. $18 billion, with a B, in subsidies compared to our $5 billion, give or take. They have to get off of fossil fuels. The people are demanding it. Now, I saw, Andy reminds me, I saw one of those photographs of Beijing, and the caption underneath it said, "This is not a screen cap. This is not a still from Blade Runner." Because you know what it looked like? It looked like Blade Runner. Perpetual night, even in bright daylight. The photo I saw, I think, was taken around noon. And it was of a skyscraper with a giant video screen with a woman's face on it. Anybody who has seen Blade Runner knows what that looks like. It is reality. The Chinese know it. The Indians know it. The Chinese and the Indians are placing demands on coal, oil, and gas as a stopgap until they can get a clean energy future going for them. The clean energy future is already happening in places like Germany and Brazil. And the question that I put to Will is the question that I persist in asking. What happens when the rest of the world sees the United States as not an, but the impediment to the ongoing survival, not just of their country, but of our species? Because you see, right now, that is where we are. The United States of America, which prides itself on being a force for good, a bringer of freedom, a savior of democracy, the United States of America is quite possibly the greatest impediment to the ongoing survival of the human species that is at work in the world today. That notion dawned on me earlier, and I was just stopped in my tracks. Because I imagined myself saying that to my father. Dad would have blustered at me a bit and maybe got a little bit pissed off. And, "Well, I didn't go out in the South Pacific." No, you didn't, Dad. But that's where we are. The oil companies, and you know it, I don't even have to express this. The oil companies are more than willing to burn this planet to a cinder. So are the coal companies. So are the gas companies. You know, it's not exactly something you would call.
Oh, God.
Okay. So we did have another little technical issue there, but it got sorted out along the way, too. But what you just heard was not a technical issue. Oh, no. No, no. Yeah, there's a little tongue speaking going on back there. That is audio from the Holy Word Deliverance Church Ministry Tabernacle somewhere near St. Louis, Missouri. That is the Reverend Alois Bell. And Alois Bell is the woman who signed her check, I give God 10%. Why do you get 18%? And stiffed her waitress in the story that we covered this past Wednesday night. Because people, it turned out we found out who she was. And we found out who she was, or not we, I mean, I didn't do any of this. The story is available out there online. But it turns out that she kind of outed herself because she called raising such a stink to the Applebee's restaurant, and who would eat at Applebee's, I don't know. Last time we went there, I got squirted with half and half. And no, it was not the holy milk of Jesus Christ. But she raised such a stink at Applebee's that they fired the waitress who uploaded the check on which she stiffed her server. She also offered, by way of explanation, saying, well, I did leave $6 on the table. Sure you did, Pastor. Sure you did.
That's the 10% she gives God.
Speak up, dear.
Well, move your big head.
It's a unidirectional supercardioid pattern microphone. Go right ahead. Now.
Yes, but you have to move your head.
My big old alien head.
Your big old alien head. If that's the 10% she gives God, he's just telling her to keep the change.
And that's your daily Agnes. I had to share that though because. You had to, she just, In the name of Jesus, in the name of Jesus, but in the name of running a server half to death, she complained, for 20 people, she complains about a mandatory tip of 18% that gets added to the check. Just so everybody understands. Right? Yeah. We couldn't just leave that laying around till Monday. It had to be followed up on, and thanks to Isaac for sending the story along. Just in case we're not properly sanctified.
Oh, God, we declare, God, everything, God. Oh, God, we declare now everything, God, that you have for us, God. In the name of Jesus, God, we declare now, God. Oh, God, we will thank you, God. In the name of Jesus, God. Oh, God, I praise you, man.
Yeah, but see, she's got the right idea. I'll bet you in about 5 years' time she'll be a multimillionaire with a couple of jets and a Bentley and a gig on, I don't know, TBN or Trinity or whatever it is. Yeah, nice, huh? And you guys thought I was kidding with what we that mild-mannered little freak that we haul out and let come and play on early on Wednesday evenings, hollering about blood red carpets and so forth. That's child's play. This woman's gone pro. I'm going to have to learn how to do this.
In the name of Jesus, God. Oh, God, we just need you even the more, God. In the name of Jesus, God. Oh, God, we need you.
And the thing, you know what the fascinating thing is? You can pass by folks on the streets. and they seem perfectly normal. But if you were to wander into their weird little storefront churches, you'd find this. Reason, common sense, all just gone, gone, gone. Texas Betsy pointing out, people who screech their prayers don't know enough Bible or liturgy to do it properly, in my opinion. Different strokes for different folks. I reckon I don't care if she screeches it or hollers it or drops a sledgehammer on her toe and lets the Spirit speak through her then. But if that's who you are inside the church, but out to Applebee's, you're stiffing the waitress and then turning around and getting one of them fired in the dead of winter, yeah, your faith is not as a mustard seed. Your faith is as a garbage bag, right? But I felt like we had to have that update, and I feel much better for having done it. We got other fun out there. Marty sent this along earlier in the evening. And again, this is one that will not wait until more in Monday. You know, of course, that this is the first day of February, and February marks Black History Month. Black History Month having been more or less created by Carter Woodson, a man who at one point in time was a coal miner, an underground coal miner in West Virginia. You can learn about him by reading Jeff Bigger's work, The United States of Appalachia, being a required reading text at the Horn. It's Black History Month. And I always thought there was no small amount of irony in the fact that Black History Month is the shortest month in the year. Okay, we're going to create Black History Month. What do you think? Which month? Yeah, there's really nothing going on. Yeah, February sounds good. Yeah, it'll be okay. It's over a little quick. It's just 4 weeks. And every now and then, A white person will betray themselves and the seeds of bigotry and prejudice they carry in them by saying something stupid like, why is there no White History Month? Never noting or never realizing, lost in the depths of their ignorance, that every month is White History Month. The white people have just did a very, very, very determined and dedicated and thorough job trying to make sure that there was nothing left on this planet but white history, succeeding to the point that most folks, white folks in this country, run around thinking that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, was as white or whiter than them, whiter than a bar of ivory soap, blue-eyed, blonde-haired, and they're waiting for him to come back in the clouds. And when a little short, stocky, black, curly, black-headed brown guy shows up, I'm back. Who the hell are you? Right? Well, one of those folks has come along. And she's a real Lulu, too. The blog Wonkette called the post that we're about to talk about, quote, a big pile of shit mouth. What we're talking about is Victoria Jackson. Victoria Jackson, former not very talented Saturday Night Live cast member, ukulele player, attendant at Tea Party road trip rallies all over the country in the last couple of years, and one of the few women on earth who can make people think, you know, that Sarah Palin might not be so stupid. How stupid is Sarah Palin? Did you read the article? Did you see it? Some wonky policy think tank, whatever, I think at a university in Minnesota, calculated the number of words that Caribou Barbie, Mussolini, Moosferatu had uttered on Fox News over the last few years during her job there, which has mercifully and recently come to an end. And as the saying goes, they added two and two together and added 12 and carried five and came up with, get this, Sarah Palin was paid $15.85 per word. Rich Smith and I were talking about that last night. And I said, you know what? I'd love to have $15.85 a word for one show. Hell, we could take care of a couple of months' bills on that. But no, Victoria Jackson. Put up a column which she posted to her personal website. And she wrote the following. I will not try to do the helium-voiced Victoria Jackson accent. I don't think my poor little vocal cords could stand it. I'm just really tired of the white male, and especially the white conservative Christian male, being attacked in cartoons, movies, TV shows, politics, affirmative action, etc. The etc. was hers, not mine. The thing apparently went on and on and on, talking about how wonderful Caucasian males are. And she says that Caucasian males are responsible for every good thing in America. But again, having something like logic and reasoning lost on her, she cannot acknowledge that, well, if white folks are responsible for all the good stuff, they have to take equal responsibility for the bad. Except they're not responsible for the good stuff. Jazz? Anybody? White folks? Rock and roll? Anybody? Bueller? White folks? Civil rights? Denial of civil rights. Oh, white folks did that. How about most of the cuisine that we recognize as being American? So here's her list. Just for the record, white men invented rockets, space travel. Do we really want to have that long-term, that long-form conversation about Wernher von Braun? Do we really, Victoria? Rockets, space travel, airplanes. Oh, I know white men invented airplanes because, like I said, I looked under the seat cushion of my aircraft coming back from San Francisco, and I saw Wilbur and Orville were here on the underside cushion. Oh, stop it. I may start speaking in tongues. I'm going back to the beginning so I can get through this. Just for the record, white men invented rockets, space travel, airplanes, the automobile, the English language. Jesus, I'm glad I don't have a baseball bat. I'd just spontaneously start beating on things. The English language, the USA, most medical advances, electricity, invented electricity. You got that? Invented. Television, telescope, microscope, Ivy League universities, the computer. Vicky, sweetheart, honey. I really don't think you want to be talking about white folks inventing computers, because sooner or later you're going to run over and you're going to start learning if what goes on inside your mind can be referred to as learning. about, what was his name, Alan Turing? Gay man? Yeah. The internet and on. I think white men should be praised and respected. White Christian conservative men especially should be loved and adored. They were the backbone and originators of the greatest nation on earth. We need more of them now. She also went on to take issue with Alec Baldwin because of his statement that the Obama second term signals the end, quote, end of white middle-aged Christian dominance. Victoria Jackson took the bait and said that everything that's wrong with America happens as a result of that. Everything from drugs to disappearing freedom. Yeah, that freedom that disappears when you go to the doctor on that Obamacare. All those 25-year-olds who are on their parents' health care policies now, they are living in chains because they're no longer free, because that Obamacare is a freedom killer, right? Yeah. As noted, Wonkette referred to it as a big pile of shit mouth. I was just looking for an excuse to say that again. She disappeared it because nobody has told yet, nobody has yet told Victoria Jackson that the internet never forgets. She pulled it from her website thinking she had made it go bye-bye and then could say that it didn't really exist. Oh, there's another beauty, another word for Sarah Palin coming from Texas Betsy. Palinocchio. You got a giggle from Margie on that one, Texas Betsy. Texas Betsy said they should pay me that, they should pay me that per word. Here's a beautiful one. Michael writing Sebastopol. It says, Caucasians made the piano Duke Ellington played. White folks, I will add, made the trumpet Louis Armstrong played. White folks made the Fender Stratocaster Jimi Hendrix played. And on and on and on. Texas Betsy says, howdy, Margie. Okay, so we've gotten that taken care of. Well, see, Marty gets the idea. He says, it'll be a much longer time than it's already been before my shadow sees the inside of an Applebee's again. It's really not going to be, I don't think you're going to sacrifice much, Marty. So those two were just at the top of the list for this Friday on the front porch. And by the way, you know, I'm signed into Skype here. Let me make sure that I'm visible. Hello, it's Skype. Yeah, I'm visible. If you want to get involved in the program, take part in the conversation, it seems like the machines are operating and cooperating. The handle here, the contact address is Bob Kincaid Horn. B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn, if you want to make contact via Skype. But Lord knows we're busy here. Now, so we've got Victoria Jackson, Christian, declaring that she is disgusted, that she wants a White History Month. I hope Dr. John is out having a beer on a Friday night like he ought to be, or, because that whole White History Month thing is going to drive him crazy when he gets around to it. I'll get a note. I know I will. Being as how Dr. John knows a lot about the history that white folks desperately tried to suppress. Dick Gregory said something to me this afternoon that was absolutely brilliant. He said, white folks didn't even let their women vote until 1921. I figure my mama would be best not even coming out of the house. Yeah. Now, I got a chance to meet Dick Gregory and talk to him a little bit. I've admired him for a very long time. He's the man who very, very long ago, although other people have been credited with it, a long time ago, Dick Gregory said, if Jesus Christ had been killed in the electric chair, we'd all be walking around with little electric chairs hanging around our necks. Which brings a certain perspective or focus to the idea of icons and imagery. You reckon, assuming he does come back, which I think is probably nearly 100% not likely to happen. No, it is 100% not likely to happen. It ain't going to happen. You reckon the first thing that he's going to want to see is a lot of buildings with crosses on the top of them? Not going in there. Not going in there. Not going to... Oh, they're still doing it? They're celebrating it? They got a guy hanging up on a cross up at the end of their building? I don't think I see that. I don't know who that guy is. All blonde-haired and blue-eyed. Sure did suck to be me that day. Wonder who that guy is that they crucified. You get it? But we've got what do we call her? Pastor Stiff? Pastor Cheapskate? Now we have Victoria Shitmouth. That was going to be like Beetlejuice after a while. I just love the way Margie giggles in the background. It's like having Tinkerbell over your shoulder. It's got a delightful little laugh. But then there's this. And honest to God, you cannot make it up. In the ongoing court case, or cases, over marriage equality, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops have filed an amicus curiae brief, which is a friend of the court brief. There are two marriage equality cases that are presently before the Supreme Court of the United States. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops wants the court to understand what God has told them to think of marriage equality. This is a direct quote, and it's rather lengthy, so bear with me, please. This is a direct quote from the amicus curiae brief of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and I'm not kidding. In contrast, in contrast to the classes for which this court has applied heightened scrutiny, what lower courts have understood to be a homosexual orientation is not a trait attributable from conception or birth. Rather, particularly as framed by respondents have, it involves a species of conduct. Not bad. No, come on, it was terrible. Do you have that? The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops have declared that being gay does not happen at birth. Now, understand, these are the same the same dress wearing men with their little House of Whoville hats and their fabulous shoes who declare that they know, they don't suspect,
They don't surmise. They don't theorize. They don't hypothesize. But they know, all the way down to their recently sucked little toenails, that the instant a sperm, a lucky, lucky, lucky sperm, runs into one of those sensuous, sensuous eggs, that in that instant, that little wad of tissue that is microscopic, in that very moment, that it is a fully vested human being. They know that. They are able to declare that with the wisdom that passes all understanding, or something they figured out with a Ouija board, or I don't know. The Balrog told them. They know all of that. And because they know all of that, they can inform the court. And I get a little nervous about amicus curiae briefs from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops going before the court, because, well, you've got walking, talking, hallucinating freaks like Fat Tony Scalia, who will probably listen to that as some sort of holy writ. Now, he might just take them seriously. Because the bishops say that homosexual orientation is not a trait attributable from conception or birth, like being female or being a dark skin. They're pushing back against that hope. Burn that ray motion. Well, I don't know what pushed the audio over the edge, but something did. I apologize. There's not much I can do about it. Unless we're going to go through that whole restart thing. Is it out of a... Can it be understood to be English? Can it be understood to be human? I don't know. But the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops have declared that homosexuality is merely conduct. And that homosexuality is nothing more than a voluntary action. Here's the sentence. Any voluntary action that is not or has ever been illegal would readily satisfy the factor of having suffered government disfavor or a history of discrimination based on a distinguishing trait. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, without invoking the name of Willard Romney's grandfather, then goes on and compares marriage equality between two men or two women deeply involved in a loving relationship to polygamy. Really? Well, at least we got in a few minutes worth of broadcasting. I'm so sorry for the way this audio keeps going sideways. If there was something I was doing that was making it happen, I would quit doing it. But all I can do at this point is just quit. So y'all have a good night and a happy weekend, and hopefully this won't happen on Monday. Bye now.
triple torment. I like that, Tom's triple torment. Tom says, I especially would like to urge listeners who haven't ever contributed to take advantage of this. The small, how small, core of contributors could use some help. If you haven't contributed, please ask yourself, Tom says, if you can. It doesn't have to be a lot. Just $5 or $10 a month would help keep the horn on the air. And that's exactly how we stay on the air. Tom says, by way of explanation, I came across the horn way back near the beginning. I was at White Rose looking for Hartman podcasts and sampled a few other shows, and I was hooked. Eventually, when the funding ran dry and you started asking for help, I said to myself, I can do that. I haven't been absolutely regular with my contributions, but I try, and I'm proud that I have helped keep the program going. Please, each of you listening, ask yourself, can you do that? And then do it. Tom closes saying, I feel a real personal connection with so many of the Horn family, Jim, Sandra, Albert, Bill, and so many more. Tracy's brought me to tears twice. Wow. Personally, I would be devastated to lose this. Anyone else? Step up. End of public appeal. Thank you, Tom, and thank you for all the help we've gotten that you've sent our way over the years. It has been indeed a long haul, but it is nice to know that it's nice to see that I think we are we're putting together at least the basics of a completely different model here. And it's a model whereby those who can do, do what they may do. Does that make any sense? I think it does. And so, pardon me, I'm doing a little tech on the fly, too. Let's see if that helps a little bit. Just checking levels again. This all kind of happens on the fly. Hopefully this is sorted out now, though. I think we may have found the source of the problem. It was very important for me to try to get on the air this evening because, A, I hate missing shows. B, I hate missing shows for technical reasons. And C, I'm on the road, in the air tomorrow. And I hope we do get, some of us get an opportunity to at least meet. It's always fun to meet members of the Horn family, even at a distance. As I've noted, I'm headed out to San Francisco tomorrow for the memorial service for a brilliant woman who passed away way too early in life. A woman by the name of Becky Tarbutton from a magnificent organization called the Rainforest Action Network. You may recall that they were the folks with whom I went to Charlotte, North Carolina last spring and was able to talk a little bit of truth, a little bit of straight skinny to the CEO of Bank of America. And Becky passed away in a really, really horrible, sad accident the day after Christmas, so her memorial is Saturday in San Francisco, and I'm going out there to pay my respects. But hopefully there will be time, and maybe we'll just get to meet and greet, shake hands a little bit somewhere along the way. And so the way the schedule works out is as follows. No show tomorrow night. No show Monday because I think my flight from California back to here gets in, it's like 10 o'clock at night or something. After that, we'll have shows on Tuesday and Wednesday, regular shows from right here at the AIC headquarters. Then on Thursday and Friday, we will be live from Families USA Health Action, also here in Washington, D.C., with a host of brilliant advocates, activists, and guests who can give us hopefully a good idea of where we go from here now that the Affordable Care Act has been largely, if not entirely, upheld, and what that means for the future of people who can afford health insurance and, well, because I've kind of got a dog in this hunt, people who can't. So that is Thursday and Friday of next week. After that, the things are a little bit in flux. It looks like we will very likely still be in D.C. the week following, but we're playing that part by ear. But anyway, no show on Friday, no show on Monday, but everything else, we should be good to go next week. One of the reasons that I was so absolutely insistent about getting on air tonight was because we have a wealth of contributions of content and ideas from members of the Horn family, coming in via email overnight. We have heard, I have a note here from our buddy Scott in Sweden. I also have a note here from our buddy Dr. John. All of which relates to some of the stuff that we were talking about yesterday evening. And then, of course, there's actual news to go into. There was also a late breaking note coming in from our buddy Tosh, who had just got done listening to last night's show. You know that maybe you're doing something right when the subject line of the email simply says R-O-F-L-M-A-O and a string of exclamation points. Tosh writes, rubber chicken to a sword fight. Add that to recently finally seeing The Princess Bride, the sword fight between Inigo Montoya and the Dread Pirate Roberts, a.k.a. Wesley. Tosh says, I lost it. And yes, Tosh, you are free to... this is an open-source program and licensed under the Creative Commons. So, yeah, absolutely, take rubber chicken to a sword fight and hand it to your son who is studying up on being a comedian. It's nothing more honorable than having a funny guy take something funny and make something funnier out of it. I told you that we had, speaking of Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, the man of whom we said he took a rubber chicken to a sword fight yesterday in trying to deal with Secretary of State Clinton with his little delusions of, if I were president, or if monkeys flew out my butt, or if I had a brain. Well, Scott got the podcast, and this morning I opened up the email, and Scott was also kind enough to provide background music.
Hey, hey, roll and go. Our boots and our clothes, boys, are all in the pond. And we're rollicking randy dandy, oh. Heave a pull, oh, heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board.
Scott, writing from Sweden, says, Yo-ho, Roberto, mi hearty. Aye, true it is that Randy Paul might have swam with Aqua Buddha a time or many. Or truer still that he's been a keel hauled a more than what's good for a lad. But nay, avast!
Do you doubt that Barbary pirates there be? Belay that, matey. The corsair that Fox and the whirl-a-nut dainties espied none or be than one of the three fair galleons, La Nun, La Puta, and La Santa Maria, that jolly Saddam used to spirit away his 36-pounders of mass destruction in the Yar of our Lord 2003. You not be forgetting that, do you, matey? Why, Fox and the whirly dainties have told us all about it then, too, they did. O's for Randy Paul, while many a mate has long aspired to ram a wet sponge his muzzle down, or bang him with boiling tar, bung him with boiling tar, leave him blow till 8 bells, call him out. He's a good lad for the horse latitudes, when nary another breeze there be the mainsail to fill. Oh, when the grog's all gone, his tales do stupefy just as well. Signed, our buddy, Scott. Take your hands from your pockets and don't suck your thumbs to me. Rollickin' Randy Dandy, oh, heave a pull, oh, heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cable's all stored to me. Rollickin' Randy Dandy, oh. Roust her up, please, a wind drawing free. Way, hey, roll and go. Let's get the glad rags on and drive her to sea. To me, rollicking Randy Dandy, oh.
Many thanks to Scott for that, because I think we have a new name for Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. Randy Paul. Randy Dandy-O. One would hope that little moments like Randy Paul's... By the way, I should have told you the title of Scott's email was Ahoy, Scuttlebutt of the Sleaze of the Seven Seas. I've been waiting all day. This is a big part of why I was so... absolutely nuts to get on the air. Aye, true it is that Randy Paul might have swum with Aqua Buddha a time a tree or many. It's not just every day you get an email that says, many a mate has long aspired to ram a wet sponge his muzzle down or bung him with boiling tar. Yeah, that ruin. Bung him with boiling tar, leave him blow till 8 bells, call him out. A good lad for the horse latitudes. He comes from horse country. Oh, that's pro stuff. That's pro stuff. And many thanks to... many thanks to Scott for sending along the background music as well. And then this came in also in regard to info from last night. A story covered toward the end of the program with a delightful coda as offered by our buddy Robert in Australia. A note came in from Dr. John. The title to this note, Of Boat-Shaped Mud Flows and the Curse of Ham. Of Boat-Shaped Mud Flows and the Curse of Ham.
Bob. Just finished last night's program. It was stellar. One for the archives. But I felt a bit like Gollum, in a way. The morality, it burns as us. Two things in particular, John says, Dr. John, regarding the boat-shaped mudflows and Noah's Ark. I'll say this. I'm no geologist, which means I don't pretend to have a great depth of knowledge about geologic processes. I know, as they say, just enough to be dangerous. This, I'll say this editorially, as compared to Dr. Newton Leroy Gingrich, amateur paleontologist, who has explained to us all that evolution's a bunch of bunk, right? Yeah. But unlike, Dr. John says, a right-winger, see above, Dr. Newton Leroy Gingrich, amateur paleontologist, but unlike a right-winger, whose first reaction to something he doesn't understand is to hop around it hooting and throwing feces and hitting it with expedient clubs like a not-too-bright ape, I listen to experts. I appreciate that a real geologist probably knows what he or she is talking about. Oh, that's a mudflow, not an arc, is usually good enough for me. Especially when the explanation rests on natural observable phenomena. What got me interested was the mountain-climbing Fundy woman's statement to the effect of, most Christians think the Ark is on Mount Ararat, but it really depends on the country that existed at the time. Screeching halt, says Dr. John. Quote, depends on the country that existed at the time? Now, we could go off on a long discussion of the rise of modern nation-states, the formation of Turkey from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire, the advances in population, economics, and transportation that are required to speak of a nation in any meaningful sense, and how none of those things had occurred at the time of the reputed flood. No nations, no country that existed at the time. But no, Dr. John concludes, no, it'd be pointless, because this is the kind of collapsing of history that you can expect among New Earth fundies. There's no way you can fit a few thousand years of human history as we slouched our way through the Neolithic Revolution and into the present. Dr. John, did we really slouch? I always kind of had some respect for all those flint nappers and whatnot, as we slouched our way through the Neolithic Revolution and into the present, into a framework that's, what, 5, 6, 7,000 years old? It's pointless to tell her that there were no countries at the time of the flood, because the social forces that lead to nations, like, writing, hadn't been invented yet. There's always been writing. There's always been Turkey. There's always been capitalism and freedom. And I'll add frisbees and wheat checks. Incidentally, Dr. John continues, young earth creationism has essentially been laughed out of polite society by the end of the 19th century in the U.S. and Britain. It has reemerged periodically since then. The latest round is simply, well, the latest round. If anyone's interested in a long, accessible, but meaty book, I highly recommend Evolution, The History of an Idea, by Peter J. Bowler. It's a social history of the theory of evolution from before Darwin through the genetic synthesis. It deals with how the social context has shaped the alternating embrace of and opposition to evolution. It is fascinating. Which brings me, Dr. John adds, to the curse of Ham.
You remember the curse of ham from last night? Entirely different from the curse of pastrami, which wakes you up about 3 o'clock in the morning. This is growing overly long, Dr. John says. No, it's really not. We could go on for days with this, Dr. John. So I'll keep it tight. The humbling, beautiful, dare I say, magical thing about evolution is how it simply and elegantly ties all life on Earth together. That means all people on Earth are tied together by similarity, not difference. Consider this. There are 7 billion people on the planet. Every human has 2^23 possible combinations of chromosomes in his or her sex cells. That means 2 humans could theoretically produce 70 trillion genetically unique offspring. Let that one rattle around for a little bit. We don't need a vengeful creator to make us different. We have the potential for difference inside our own bodies. But that potential's just skin deep, and it takes the idea of a vengeful creator to give meaning to it, to give some people a reason to hate the other, that's the capital O, other, rather than embrace diversity. If he's not at work, I expect in about 15 seconds to get an email in the series from our buddy Ron in Raleigh saying, Today on the EIB, my friends, a discussion of whence comes diversity and the geological failings for people who claim mud flows are actually boats. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, Ron, but you've got me thinking in that direction, so you've created a meme, as it were. I can sit and ruminate on both the content of Dr. John's and of Scott's note for days on end. One makes me giggle. The other makes me scratch my head and just wonder at it all. And yet somewhere, probably in Texas, a child is being taught that evolution can't possibly be true because our evolutionary forebears aren't still around. At which point you realize that just as Dr. John pointed out, trying to educate these fools is probably largely earned in its own right. And it's not the fools we worry about. It's what the fools are doing to the beautiful young minds that they are. Well, they're hamstringing them, aren't they? It's a form of child abuse to teach a little one that Adam and Eve rode dinosaurs to church or had vegetarian picnics with tyrannosaurs, such as is displayed, no, neatly, down at the Creation Museum, you know, the one that's subsidized by Commonwealth of Kentucky tax dollars, yeah, down in Kentucky Stan. Well, this is the curse of what happens when you engineer on the fly. Is that any better? Getting some queries about trying to get levels up. We'll get there.
Thanks, by the way. We are $20 toward meeting Tom's triple torment challenge for this Thorn in the Side Thursday. So thank you very much, and that makes it that much easier to get the rest of the way. What else? What else do we have? Oh, Lord. See, that's the thing. There was probably 5 hours worth of material tonight at the beginning of the program. Most of it still there and still untouched. And we'll get to as much of it as we can. But I should also note that we are the Skype line is available for your access should you choose so to do. You can reach the program on Skype. The handle here is Bob Kincaid, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. And that'll get you right into the program. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday, and we do our fair share of finding the little moments of insanity from the right wing. You know, the kind that's like the tickle in the back of your throat that's the front. You can't reach it. If you could, you'd put your hand down. You'd just scratch. Yeah, it's an itch you can't scratch. And so we've got that stuff to work with. We've got a little religious persecution back down in Kentucky Stan, the Commonwealth. But we've also got, you know how last night we talked a little bit about the military deciding to scrap the rules that said women could not serve in combat units, you know, frontline combat units. You might recall Ron and Raleigh started the program off last night with an email called Cindy, Take the Point. There are problems that come with such a decision, but today, and I remain a man of peace. I think our military budget is far in excess of anything that is justified. But it is a military industrial complex, and we have the military we have not just because of our intense global paranoia, but because it is an employment program. You know, for years and years and years, military personnel were never counted among those who were counted by the Labor Department in the employment numbers. That changed under the Reagan administration. That's when we started counting soldiers and airmen and Marines and sailors within the employment numbers, because otherwise the Reagan Revolution would have looked like a giant Reagan failure. But the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's General Martin Dempsey, said today that he hopes that the sexual harassment and rape problem that the military has will be ameliorated by allowing women into the combat ranks. He said, I believe it's because we've had separate classes of military personnel at some level discussing why the sexual harassment problems exist. He says, I have to believe the more we treat people equally, the more likely they are to treat each other equally. Well, that's at least a respectably thought out position. as opposed to, say, oh, I don't know, the Wall Street Journal. That little honk you just heard in the background is Ferg. He's already seen this story. Really, the Wall Street Journal. Of course, it's owned by Rupert Murdoch now, so it's about as factual and about as accurate as, say, Fox News Radio Rwanda. But no, it takes a lot to have the nerve to assert what the Wall Street Journal asserted just today. Oh, they got their fulminating hat on, the Wall Street Journal did. And being as how they are America's voice for the business community, of conservative traditionalists, the Wall Street Journal felt it incumbent upon themselves to explain to us lumpen proletariats walking around on our knuckles out here and breathing through our mouths and eating with our hands and not knowing which fork to use with the shrimp, to explain to us just why it is that the women folk can't be out there in the front lines. I thought Ron and Raleigh offered a good argument against it last night. This is not that. No. Instead, the Wall Street Journal felt themselves compelled to go to a place that you and I would probably never dream of going. They tried the argument, well, you know, the women folk don't have the same upper body strength as the men folk do, and they're not as fast, and, well, they may not be as smart, and they're just not your warrior. They're nurturing people. We don't need people nurturing out there on the front lines against, you know, our global enemies. And that didn't fly. Not when all it takes is a finger pull to make God knows how many rounds of NATO-approved 5.56-millimeter ammunition fly out the muzzle of an M4 rifle. Not, in fact, when you consider, and this is not an endorsement, it is not a criticism, the fact that, oh, other militaries have women in combat positions who are undoubtedly very, very deadly. So the Wall Street Journal, on this Thorn in the Side Thursday, said this. I'm going to try not to squeal or yell or holler or laugh uproariously. Societal norms are a reality, and their maintenance is important to most members of a society. It is humiliating enough to relieve yourself in front of your male comrades. Obviously, the Wall Street Journal has never been drunk out back of a bar next to the dumpster about 1 o'clock in the morning when, you know, when some Weisenheimer's plugged up the John and the... then again, I imagine the Wall Street Journal folks don't go to the same kind of roadhouses we do. I mean, there's a reason the word pissing contest is a phrase inside the English language. But anyway, never mind the folks who... Let's get back to work. One can only imagine the humiliation of being forced to relieve yourself in front of the opposite sex. Not to say what anyone's norms are or anything, but it's apparent that nobody at the Wall Street Journal is married or has children or has ever changed a diaper or potty trained. It is humiliating. Now, we're talking about a combat circumstance. It is humiliating enough to relieve yourself in front of your male comrades. Now, I'm not doing this for prurient reasons. This is what passes. Really, not kidding. This is what passes for deep policy thinking over at the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. I wouldn't be okay. I would disagree with it. I would disagree with the premises, the concepts, but I would expect to see this over at Wingnut Daily or Newsmuck or on the pages of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review or the Washington Mooney Times. This is the Wall Street Journal. These are the guys who go get their suits made for them. Oh, pardon me, sir, do you dress left or do you dress right? This op-ed is by former Marine infantryman Ryan Smith. Former Marine infantryman Ryan Smith, and one wonders how much actual combat he saw as a Marine, if this is what he is obsessed about. Well, he claims to have served in the 2003 invasion of Iraq as a Marine infantry squad leader. And usually this kind of thing falls under the general heading of waving the bloody shirt. Although in this case, I think the shirt is brown. I served in the 2003 invasion of Iraq as a Marine infantry squad leader. We rode into war crammed in the back of amphibious assault vehicles. They are designed to hold roughly 15 Marines snugly. You still out there, Dr. John? Did you catch that little bit of wordsmithery there? They are designed to hold roughly 15 Marines snugly. I never knew a Marine could be snugly. But they're also being held roughly. Throw him to the floor, Centurion. Woofly. Shall I throw him to the floor again? Oh, yes, Centurion, woof we. They are designed to hold roughly 15 Marines, because Marines don't do anything that isn't roughly. Now, I'm not making sport of the Marines. I'm making sport of this poor, paranoid, misogynistic woman, terrified of women dude, who probably has some issues. Just saying. They're designed to hold roughly 15 Marines snugly. Due to maintenance issues, by the end of the invasion, we had as many as 25 men stuffed into the back. Marines were forced to sit in full gear on each other's laps and in contorted positions for hours on end. That was the least of our problems. The invasion was a blitzkrieg. The goal was to move as fast to Baghdad as possible. The column would not stop for a lance corporal, sergeant, lieutenant, or even a company commander to go to the restroom. No, really, we're going... I'm sorry. I didn't write it. This is the bold and brilliant thinking you can find on any day inside the pages of the Wall Street Journal. Sometimes we spent over 48 hours on the move without exiting the vehicles. We were forced to urinate in empty water bottles. Marine, when I say you'll urinate in that empty bottle, I'm going to force you. We were forced to urinate in empty bottles inches from our comrades. A lot of forcing going on. Many Marines developed dysentery from the complete lack of sanitary conditions. When an uncontrollable urge hit a Marine, because, you know, he's certainly not speaking for a soldier in the Army or an airman or a sailor. When an uncontrollable urge hit a Marine, he would be forced to stand as best he could, hold an MRE bag up to his rear, and defecate inches from his seated comrade's face. During the invasion, we wore chemical protective suits because of the fear of chemical or biological weapon attack by people who didn't have any of them. I'm sorry, I added that last part. These are equivalent to a ski jumpsuit and hold in the heat. We also had to wear black rubber boots over our desert boots. On the occasions the column did stop, we would quickly peel off our rubber boots, desert boots, and socks to let our feet air out. It goes on like this, and on. And then our Marine, Mr. Smith, who is now an attorney with issues. We were roughly held snugly. Comes to his conclusion. Societal norms are a reality, and their maintenance is important to most members of a society. It is humiliating enough to relieve yourself in front of your male comrades. One can only imagine the humiliation of being forced to relieve yourself in front of the opposite sex. Despite the professionalism of Marines, it would be distracting and potentially traumatizing to be forced to be naked in front of the opposite sex. Wait a minute, where have I heard that before? Oh, I'm sorry. The Pentagon and the CIA thought it would be a great idea to have Iraqi prisoners piled into a pyramid playing with their own genitals in front of Lindy England. See, this is not that. That was a situation of, what's the word I'm looking for here? Oh, yeah, torture. But let's go back to our Marine here. It would be distracting and potentially traumatizing to be forced to be naked in front of the opposite sex, particularly when your body has been ravaged by lack of hygiene. In the reverse, no, I didn't make that up. In the reverse, it would be painful to witness a member of the opposite sex in such an uncomfortable and awkward position. We're in Washington, D.C. I left Dr. Freud at home. I miss him right now. This guy could put an entire family, an entire family of a psychiatrist, he could put his entire family, all of his kids, through dental school just with this letter. Let us talk about this humiliation fantasy. Oh, he's here after all. How about that? We need to talk about these humiliation fantasies you have, Corporal. The relationship combat effectiveness is based in large part on unit cohesion. The relationships among members of a unit, he said unit, can be irreparably harmed by forcing them to violate societal norms. Oh, God. Sergi writes in, is it just me, or does this guy seem like he's in denial about a little something? You just had to say little something, didn't you, Sergi? He seems to really have a problem being up close and personal with other men. Any man secure in his sexuality can be in such conditions without bitching about it so much. P.S. Thank God I put down the root beer before that story. Yeah, because Sergi spit-taped his monitor with Sunkist last night. It's not like I didn't... Yeah, that was the boat-shaped mud flow problem. A vehicle full of sweaty men. Oh, this is... This is an onion. It has layers upon layers upon layers. Come on, Ferg. Get it together, buddy. Ferg has had to leave the room. The image of the roughly held, snuggly Marine pooping into an MRE bag has done him in. Now, our buddy Fritz writes in from Arkansas. Now, I'm sure the paranoid prepper crowd, I'm a prepper, he's a prepper, she's a prepper, I'm sure the paranoid prepper crowd is going to see a new market for MREs. Extra strong MRE bags designed to hold fecal matter and double as fertilizer for those survival seed packages sold by companies advertising on that nutty Austin, Texas talk radio host show. Oh, God. See, I had real doubts about... Doing this story. From Dr. John, he says, it is time to page Dr. Freud, Bob. What the is the right-wing macho obsession with urinating? These jackholes need to Google Lyudmila Pavlichenko, a Soviet female sniper. I know about her. Lyudmila Pavlichenko, a Soviet female sniper credited with killing 309 Nazi soldiers. After being wounded, she went on a publicity tour and was hosted by President Roosevelt during her trip to the U.S. Or they could just look up Woody Guthrie's song about her. There is... Right, but see, there's a large... how do I explain this? Although our Marine here couches his argument in terms of being humiliated to have to attend to the workings of his very real, very human, very physical body. It's not what it's about. Now, see, Marty, I gave you a little bit of hope for a minute, didn't I? Marty says, when you just said the story was an onion, I thought for a moment you were saying the story was from the onion, and I really hope it is where they stole it from. No, this is real. But really, this is the kind of thing that psychiatrists send their children to dental school on. Because our Marine here says that he is worried about having someone relieve waste from their bodies near to him. But yet, he survived having it done in that roughly stuffed, snuggly troop carrier, right? Except for the fact that he's apparently still talking about it. Somebody likes something a little too much? I don't know. But see, there is a certain right-wing culture inside the military that was devastated when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was done away with. And soldiers could actually be who they are instead of having to pretend into some sort of macho right-wing heteronormative environment. Gay folks can kill brown people just as well as hetero folks can. And it is absolutely driving the right wing crazy that we're about to prove that American women can go and kill brown folks on behalf of global corporations and ExxonMobil and so forth, as well as right-wing he-men can. And then there's this. This story purports to be about men being humiliated to attend to bodily functions near a woman. As I noted, this indicates that most of this guy probably has not had a relationship of any lasting, at least not lasting enough to have a kid or change a diaper or do any potty training or even be walked in a family situation. It happens. That's not what this is about. This is about right-wing, mortified fear of women. It isn't even misogyny, per se. It's fear. And I mean water-boweling, gut-bending fear. One of the nice things about the community we've built here is that we can attempt grown-up conversations about the nature of what it is to be human. You know, the shortest verse in the New Testament is Jesus wept. But there is something in my way of thinking that says we probably needed the shortest verse in the New Testament to be Jesus pooped. Because, see, humans do that. We don't run around necessarily talking about it a lot because everybody does it. So this can't possibly be the real grounds of, what's this guy's name? The real grounds of Ryan Smith's objection. No, you need Dr. Freud for that. And this isn't hatred of women. This is fear of them. This is the deep, deep-seated, dark fear that infests males and has infested us since the time that we figured out there was a difference between the genders. This goes back to the same reason that to about the same time that humans probably learned to be fearful of the darkness. It's primal. Some of you know where I'm going with this. I'll bet you. They're not, look, let's just say it. Lance Corporal Master Lieutenant Unit Colonel Ryan Smith, whatever the he is, didn't think twice about attending to the needs of his body in combat. And he didn't hold it against his comrades for doing the same, because it's war. But what Lance Private Major Colonel Corporal Captain Ryan Smith is worried about is that he might have to be out there in one of them combat situations and see a, you know, tampon. Or maxi pad. He probably, if he's actually in a relationship with a female, he probably blushes like crazy to carry a box of feminine hygiene products up to the counter. And, it's for my wife. Oh, really? Not for you? Bust my buttons. Oh, shucks, and he's rubbing his toe in the ground and looking away, and oh, my mama done told me. Right-wingers are not fully developed humans. They cannot cope with the real world. They build themselves a military culture of macho, in which they make jokes about a woman's monthly cycle. And all that is about to maybe go away. They're also scared to death that maybe those female soldiers might turn out to be just a little bit more bloodthirsty and a little bit better killers than they ever were. And it makes their winkies shrink to the point that they can't even find it with both hands. I'm not kidding. I mean, this is not a joke. We've got thousands of years of religious traditions that talk about how filthy women are during their monthly cycle. We've got euphemisms for them. We've done everything we can to hide its reality. You know, it's kind of neat because in more progressive circles, there are actually conversations going on about non-gender normative bathrooms where everybody just deals with the fact that a bathroom is there for a reason and that it doesn't have to be his and hers and that we don't have to split the genders up simply because we're afraid that somebody's going to be overcome by a lustful urge to commit rape. Because one person's sitting down while the other one's standing up. That made it all the way onto the pages. No kidding. Of the Wall Street Journal. Sergi writes in and says, the subject line, tampons, Lord help any guy who is so insecure about such things as tampons that they need to do a price check at the counter. I can imagine their worst nightmare.
We need a price check on these Tampax Pearls, supersize.
And then somebody from the back of the store who misheard Tampax as thumbtacks replies,
is it the kind you push in with your thumb or the kind you pound in with a hammer?
Brilliant. Okay, Sergi, from the next room, I just heard my lovely wife, Agnes, declare that you are a bad man. Pound in with a hammer.
You know I'm monitoring.
Yes, I know, I know. You're listening to every...
Bad, bad,
bad. Bad, Sergi, bad.
But it's okay, I love you, Sergi.
She loves you anyway. At least Sergi acknowledges the reality that that might... Oh, God. So that's where we find ourselves as we come to the close of this truncated first hour. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We've got a call on hold on Skype, and we will go to it out of the break.
No eye contact, I'll beat you down. 'Cause you know that's not scary hero. You'll never find a human that steals school supplies. And if you do, let me know who, and I'll be down.
I like to toot out the bad vibes. That's right, I'm the best one. And when we do a show, I always start with this. And usually around 5, I lay down. Then I poop on the floor. Piano. Spaceship stored away, why not tell me they left? You gotta flush the toilet. Yeah, see that's right. Professional baby, I'm gonna find a chicken fight, then gon' go poo-poo. Mama told me she wrote me a note. She forgot that I'm a soft machine man. Hubby. Looks like we got a big mean dookie on deck. And I hate those greenish potatoes with them soggy fish sticks.
Oh, when I'm on the pot. After working for hours, wash out down there.
When I'm dumping my log,
everybody poops and if they don't, they're an android and should be destroyed.
I'm a regular bitch.
Everybody poops and if they don't, they're an android and should be destroyed.
Tissue, Virgil, use it all up, 'cause she got foul issues.
Yeah, she ain't no android, you can take my word. When I'm on the pot, after working for hours, wash out down there,
when I'm dumping my log.
Everybody poops and if they don't, it should be destroyed. Everybody poops and if they don't, they're an android. It should be destroyed.
Yeah, see, that's right. Hero.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yes, indeed. There we are. It is 1 minute past the hour of 8 o'clock here in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. And Will has waited very patiently, and it is much appreciated. Let me get the music stopped here. There you are, Phil.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good, good, good. Some thoughts. One, having actually taken a psychology class and also read a few things on my own, I think that we need to page Dr. Freud, Dr. Jung, and a few people in more recent practice, because it seems that this man who wrote the piece is so utterly terrified of the feminine form that one would think that he had been raised in a cave and never exposed to the concept of women.
Oh, I think it's absolutely... This thing just, this whole piece just crawls with terror.
Utter terror, and here's the irony. I was a reporter. Among other things I've done, I did some business reporting. And, of course, I regularly looked at the Wall Street Journal to see what they were doing, see if they could generate any ideas of doing something locally. If I had read that during my tenure as a reporter, I would have been tempted to ask an editor, can we post this as the most bizarre thing to have run in a major newspaper? I mean, good heavens. But then again, I think what we are seeing is a mental meltdown on the right. The questioning of Hillary Clinton generally showed Senators Johnson and Paul to be unworthy of commanding a garbage gal, let alone being in the U.S. Senate. I thought she handled herself with class, and it's just how weird it's getting out there is astonishing even me, and I consider myself hard to surprise. As for a thorn in my side, I'll nominate Harry Reid for a rather watered-down filibuster. But then again, what should I expect from a man who's in a warrior would probably lose an arm wrestling match with Jiminy Cricket? Am I wrong?
No.
I mean, good heavens. Reed makes me seem like Conan the Barbarian in battle rage. And I'm generally considered a very calm, collected person. I mean, the deal he struck, yes, it does make some changes around the edges, but I fear it doesn't do enough, and I'm afraid what Reed fails to understand that this is not the gentleman's game that he entered politics long ago. It is now roller derby instead of cricket, to give you a sports analogy.
And you know what, I think that's our first cricket analogy in quite some time, but very true, very true.
Right, and it's just that I'm afraid that we have a good chance of seeing little done in this Congress for the next 2 years, except for the Republicans exposing themselves for who they are and all their horror. Good heavens, the author of that Wall Street Journal piece would probably faint on hearing that line, but, yes.
I mean, we're trying to be serious here, but...
Oh, I am. I'm trying to. But one thing we have to remember is we have to be at the leading edge of change, and there can be surprises. I mean, this week I was delightfully surprised that Bibi Netanyahu got his comeuppance in the Israeli elections. He thought, well, I could declare election early and strengthen my position. What he did is he merged with he merged Likud with the Israel Beitenu party, lost 25% of the strength he had expecting the combined ticket, and now he is stuck with a Hobson's choice. To lie with a group of right-wing parties, which are so fracturous that offending one will cause his coalition to collapse, but going for a more centrist coalition that will likely push him in ways that he doesn't want to go. So I think the fact that we pretty much had a split decision in the Israeli elections proves something about politics. If you actually campaign to people, talk about the issues they want, they'll listen. And Netanyahu, much like Mitt Romney, kept on trying to portray himself as a popular, likable guy, a strong figure. In fact, that's what Netanyahu ran on, and it backfired. People want ideas. They want solutions. And I think what we're going to see worldwide are more people pressing their so-called leaders and making change. And this is, I think, what the right wing is most afraid of, change. It was William F. Buckley who said that a conservative is a man who stands in a place seeing the forward march of history and yells, halt, to paraphrase him. And I think what we're seeing in a lot of places worldwide, but particularly in the U.S., they're saying halt, and people are wondering, who the heck are these crazy guys after all?
And I don't know, Will, if it's, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing, but I think there's something else at work here. And I think we can see it in a wide variety of arenas. And that's this. It is not just that they are afraid of change. They have no, you know, the right wing complains about us saying that, you know, we have no moral center, we have no moral compass. If you don't believe what they believe, then you can't possibly be moral, right?
You're familiar. Yes, they wrap themselves in their holy books and their flags and say, if you disagree with us, you are a heretic and unpatriotic. That, you can see that around the world.
Right. But you see, the problem is they are the ones who lack that center.
Exactly.
Because the reason we are in the spot we are in, the reason the planet is burning up, the reason for the flooding, the reason for the godforsaken wars over oil and other resources, is because we are no longer able to make those ethical choices based upon doing what is right. See, I have no problem thinking that if Will was in charge, the Iraq War would never have happened. If I'd been in charge, the Iraq War would never have happened. Virtually anybody in the Horn family would never have taken us into that war based upon those lies, because those lies were immoral and unethical, and a complete rejection of everything that should be our within our value strategy, within our value set. But the other side don't make decisions that way. They make their decisions based upon how much money they can make from it.
Exactly. Money and or power and prestige. I mean, it's as if we have one group of people who are trying to use logic and ethics, whatever source those ethics are derived from, as a basis of decision, and another which is essentially treating the world as a high-stakes poker game.
But not just that. It's not just that they've profitized it. It is that their profitizing of it actually prevents the real answers from ever being found. It's not just that they get it wrong. They get it wrong in such a way as to keep us from ever getting it right. And of course, I think for instance of climate change, though. Eventually,
we can't have an honest discussion.
Well, we can't have an honest discussion, Will, because they're not honest.
Exactly.
But the other thing is, their dishonesty will keep this world burning until it's too late. And see, one of the things that I fear in the future is that when climate change does become, and I was thinking about this because of Senator Kerry's remarks earlier today, about how he's going to, you know, he wants to use the Secretary of State's platform to address climate change. I can very easily see a future. Is it 100 years from now? I don't know. Is it 50? I don't know. But it doesn't take much of an imagination to
envision a future in which the rest of the world addresses the issues of climate change and then looks at us with 5% of the world's population consuming at least 25% and maybe more of the world's resources and decides that we have to be stopped?
That is actually something I have thought can happen, because if we are the main source of the problem of global warming and something can be done, if we are not doing our part, the other nations will, by logic, any logical standard, have to act in their best interest. In fact, some would even say that acting against us would be in our best interest, because they can only conclude that the leadership has gone crazy. In that nightmare scenario,
the problem is, it's not even necessarily a nightmare. You know, zombies are a nightmare.
Right.
This is a reality.
We are getting closer to the tipping point.
Well, I'm sure you saw the North Korea story today, right?
I missed it as I've been researching for a job interview. But
okay. Well, I mean, here's the long and the short of it. The North Koreans say that they're testing more weapons, and that they're going to have intercontinental ballistic missiles, and all of them are aimed at us.
Gee, doesn't that just make the people in the defense industry ecstatic for a new arms race?
Well, I mean, I don't think we have to enter into an arms race with them. What it's going to do, however, is make the blood-sodden peanackers like Elliot Abrams and Wolfowitz and, you know, those chicken hawk bastards, it's going to make them salivate with glee and start planning on what they're going to buy when their stock options in various and sundry defense industries go through the roof, because they're going to start hollering for, I mean, they're already hollering for war with Iran, and Iran hasn't done anything. North Korea really, really does have nuclear weapons. But the thing is, what North Korea is doing, this is the kind of thing you get out of North Korea periodically when North Korea starts to starve.
Exactly.
It's January in North Korea, too.
Right. And as they don't have much cropland, they have to rattle the saber as opposed to the tin cup.
Well, that is their tin cup.
Exactly.
That's our cue to send food. But the thing is, North Korea, Pakistan, India, which one of these countries can really, you can argue that India is stable, but India has a rising middle class that are absolutely screaming for the perks that a middle class gets when it arises. You know, that's why a mountain in my home county in West Virginia is going to India by boat. Because it's coal. They want all that electricity. They want lots and lots of gasoline to run lots and lots of cars. And we built the model, Will. It's extremely racist for us to say to them, no, we could have it, but you can't. Just like there's a certain element of racism involved in saying that, you know, white nations can be trusted with nuclear weapons, but, you know, Iran couldn't be. There's a lot of privilege that shines through on all of this stuff, but there is also a future to be considered out there. And that is a future where, I mean, surely to goodness somebody at one of these, you know, the Bland Institute or whatever. Did I lose you, Will? There are things to be considered about what happens in terms of climate change. And what the nexus is when it really gets ugly between that and nuclear-armed nations. And that should give us tremendous pause for concern. Unless Will jumps back in, the Skype line is open. It is about 18 minutes past the hour. The Skype number is, of course, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Thanks for putting up with all the technical fun. But I'm hearing from John Fox. He says we've got some stuff to work out, but the sound is cleaner than it sounded in ages, and that's really inspiring. Now, Bob Kincaid Horn gets you to the Skype account. I don't know what happened to Will. I hate that because we were in mid-conversation. What I was talking about earlier, though, is what Senator Kerry said today when he was criticized by one of those people who can't get it right, namely Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, whose every thought, every waking idea, every breath is geared toward dragging more hydrocarbons out of the earth to burn, because, you know, he doesn't believe in climate change because he's getting wealthy not believing in climate change. Consider this, if he is confirmed as Secretary of State, John Kerry will have yay or nay over the Keystone XL pipeline, which is not just a nightmare for the climate, but a nightmare for human beings who have to live in that climate. John Barrasso of Wyoming got all hateful with him. And bless his heart, John Kerry did a pretty good imitation of Hillary Clinton. It's worth the couple of minutes it takes to listen to.
Climate change has been a big issue that you've been concerned about, focused on. It seems over the next 25 years, the global energy needs are going to increase about 50%, that emissions are going to go up significantly, primarily because of China and India, and we could do significant harm to the U.S. economy, I think, by putting additional rules and regulations with very little impact on the global climate. So in this time...
Now, right in what you just heard there is the complete right-wing brief against doing anything about climate change in a nutshell. Consumption's going to go up and emissions are going to go up and it's going to be China and India's fault. And since it's going to be their fault, well, there's no sense in us doing anything about it. And the right-wingers, because they're not very good at that whole thinking thing, say, absolutely. I mean, we could run everything on windmills and solar panels, and the world would still keep on getting hotter. Because, you know, it's solar flares, anywho. Ain't got nothing to do with it. It's solar flares. I seen it on Newsmuck the other day. So let's go back and just sort of take, yeah.
Climate change has been a big issue that you've been concerned about, focused on. It seems over the next 25 years, the global energy needs are going to increase about 50%, that emissions are going to go up significantly, primarily because of China and India, and we could do significant harm to the U.S. economy, I think, by putting additional rules and regulations with very little impact on the global climate. So in this tight budget environment with so many competing American priorities, I would ask you to give considerable thought into limiting significantly resources that would not help us as an economy, not help us as a country, and not help us globally in perhaps the efforts that you might be pursuing there. I don't know if you have specific thoughts on
it. I do.
And before we get to Senator Kerry's thoughts, just a couple of observations on Senator Barrasso's. You know, I think we used to have a can of that under the sink there. We used it on the doorknobs. Barrasso, cleans your Barrass up. Do you notice? We're going to have a 50% higher demand for energy. He just assumes that that has to be hydrocarbon energy, when in fact, China is building wind turbines for all it's worth. His assumptions are not necessarily reflected in the realities of these other countries. Because China and India are ramping up the wind, are ramping up their access to solar power, will quite possibly invent Grid 2.0, and we'll end up buying it from them because of the Barrassos of the world. But he blows right past it. He can't even bear to say wind and solar. Isn't that just... And you wouldn't necessarily know that if you weren't constantly thinking about it. And what he says about unnecessary regulation and costs are going to... That's not grounded in reality. But John Kerry has to try to be, you know, a decent human being. But still, this is pretty good. If you are someone who cares about the climate, these words are good words. The question is whether or not they can be followed by good deeds, good acts, good actions. Because again, we live in a culture that is crippled in terms of being able to do things that are right when we are confronted with things that our betters think are either profitable or expedient or both.
A lot of specific thoughts about it, Senator. More than we're going to have time to do now, so I'm not going to abuse that privilege. But I will say this to you. The solution to climate change is energy policy. And the opportunities of energy policy so vastly outweigh the downsides that you're expressing concern about. And I will spend a lot of time trying to persuade you and other colleagues of this. You want to do business and do it well in America? We got to get into the energy race. Other countries are in it. I can tell you in Massachusetts that the fastest growing sector of our economy is clean energy and energy efficiency companies. And they're growing faster than any other sector. The same is true in California. This is a job creator. I can't emphasize that strongly enough. The market that made America richer, we've always been rich, but the market that made us richer in the 1990s was the technology market. It was a $1 trillion market with 1 billion users. And we created greater wealth in America than has been created, even in the raging time of no income tax and the Pierpont Morgans and Mellons and Carnegies and Rockefellers. We created more wealth in the 1990s, and every single quintile of American worker went up. Everyone. So we can do this recognizing that the energy market is a $6 trillion market compared to one, with what, 4 billion, 5 billion users today, going up to 9 billion over the course of the next 20, 30 years. This is a place for us to recognize what other countries are doing and what our states that are growing are doing, which is there's an extraordinary amount of opportunity in modernizing America's energy grid. We don't even have a grid in America. We have a great big open gap in the circle of America. An East Coast grid, a West Coast grid, you've got a Texas grid, and then you've got a line that goes from Chicago out over to the Dakotas. We can't sell energy from Minnesota to Arizona, or from Arizona to Massachusetts, or to the cold states and so forth. It doesn't make sense. And we can't be a modern country if we don't fix that infrastructure. So I would respectfully say to you that climate change is not something to be feared in response to. I mean, the steps to respond to it, it's to be feared if we don't. 3,500 communities in our nation last year broke records for heat. We had a rail that, because of the heat, bent, and we had a derailment as a result of it. We had record fires. We had record levels of damage from Sandy, $70 billion. If we can't see the downside of spending that money and risking lives for all the changes that are taking place to agriculture, to our communities, the ocean, and so forth, then we're just ignoring what science is telling us. So I will be a passionate advocate about this, but not based on ideology, based on facts, based on science. And I hope to sit with all of you and convince you this $6 trillion market is worth millions of American jobs and leadership, and we better go after it.
At least Senator Kerry understands that the way to convince people to take climate change seriously, at least where these 1% plutocrats are concerned, is to explain to them that they can get even richer. But there are numbers involved here, and I am an abject failure at numbers. The alternative energy response to climate change market is, according to Senator Kerry, somewhere around a $6 trillion market. How much is the oil market? How much is the gas market? How much is the coal market? And how much do those real-time numbers have to do with the money that can be made in the future? For instance, our buddy Andy just pointing out, subject line, China, $18 billion in subsidies to alternative energy. Have you seen the pollution in Beijing? Yes, I have. It's 8 times above the unhealthy level. It's beyond hazardous to one's health. China is way, way outspending us in alternative energy. $18 billion, with a B, in subsidies compared to our $5 billion, give or take. They have to get off of fossil fuels. The people are demanding it. Now, I saw, Andy reminds me, I saw one of those photographs of Beijing, and the caption underneath it said, "This is not a screen cap. This is not a still from Blade Runner." Because you know what it looked like? It looked like Blade Runner. Perpetual night, even in bright daylight. The photo I saw, I think, was taken around noon, and it was of a skyscraper with a giant video screen with a woman's face on it. Anybody who has seen Blade Runner knows what that looks like. It is reality. The Chinese know it. The Indians know it. The Chinese and the Indians are placing demands on coal, oil, and gas as a stopgap until they can get a clean energy future going for them. The clean energy future is already happening in places like Germany and Brazil. And the question that I put to Will is the question that I persist in asking. What happens when the rest of the world sees the United States as not an, but the impediment to the ongoing survival, not just of their country, but of our species? Because, you see, right now, that is where we are. The United States of America, which prides itself on being a force for good, a bringer of freedom, a savior of democracy, the United States of America is quite possibly the greatest impediment to the ongoing survival of the human species that is at work in the world today. That notion dawned on me earlier, and I was just stopped in my tracks. Because I imagined myself saying that to my father. Dad would have blustered at me a bit and maybe got a little bit pissed off. And, well, I didn't go out in the South Pacific. No, you didn't, Dad. But that's where we are. The oil companies, and you know it, I don't even have to express this. The oil companies are more than willing to burn this planet to a cinder. So are the coal companies. So are the gas companies. You know, it's not exactly something you would call funny. But it's very much real. It is at least ironic. Sandra sent this story along to me. Check out this effing idiot. And I know when Sandra refers to somebody as that, that we're dealing with a real winner. You remember Robert Murray, Bob Murray, don't you? Murray Energy. This is the guy whose greed killed, a half a dozen workers in the Crandall Canyon mine. Yeah. Well, this is also the guy who said, who issued a prayer, because I remember we covered this on the program. I read the whole prayer to you. He issued a prayer asking God to forgive him for decisions they have to make to preserve the very existence of the enterprises that he, Jesus, God, has helped Bob Murray to build. Yeah. The coal, you know, the coal mines. God's in the coal business. Kind of makes you wonder why God stuck it so dang far underground if he was in. Sense of humor, I guess. Or just mean. But no, he laid off a bunch of people in a fit of pique because that one, you know, the Kenyan Muslim with the deep-seated hatred of white people and anti-colonialist policies. Yeah, that one who laid off his, whose fault? I mean, Bob Murray had to. Jesus made him lay people because that one, the communist, was reelected. Well, we're a few days out from the election now. And Bob Murray thinks maybe nobody's watching. They've called back some hourly folks. They're definitely starting it back up. Ohio's Red Bird West mine. Several locals are taking steps to get hired back on. On the other hand, a senior attorney, that was one of those folks that Bob Murray was praying for forgiveness for, said Red Bird West is still in the process of being closed down. Interestingly, the same rumors are also swirling around in the operations of Murray Energy in Illinois and Utah. What a jackass. But again, that's a decision that was not reached because it was the right decision. It was reached to satisfy some political fit. It was reached for anything but the right reason. By the way, we talked a little bit about Texas teaching standards last night, you know, the ones that include describing Judaism as an incomplete, imperfect faith system. Overnight, I heard from our buddy Michael. He sent me an email, Judaism Texas style. He said, listening to last night's podcast, you mentioned Texas public schools are teaching that Judaism is a flawed and incomplete religion. Michael asks, how do they figure that? Is that because it's lacking a final solution, perhaps? Michael closes saying, oy vey. So that was one aspect of it. Meanwhile, Texas Betsy shares this with us. This is from a fifth grade science curriculum in Texas. Science class. Not religion class. Science class. For example, it was colder in Europe from 1400 to 1800 than it was from 1100 to 1300. That was because the pattern of weather, the climate, changed between these two periods. Many scientists believe, see, that's where the science text goes right out.